Welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines on 90.7 FM KPFK. This is your host, Eric Mann. Today what we're going to do is we're going to have a conversation with Manuel Criollo, who wrote a really important article called My Brother's Keeper, President Obama Has Opened the Door. It's our job to march through it, and then Jackie Byers is going to join us from the Black Organizing Project in Oakland, who's doing some really important work. So we're going to start talking about Manuel's article, and then we're going to move to the new Separate and Equal, discussing, basically, this is all about the mass incarceration of Black and Latino peoples in the United States, whether it's on the MTA trains, whether it's in the schools, whether it's in the hospitals. It's a racist country, a racist society, and we're trying to figure out what to do about it. So that's the general conversation, which seems to be the conversation we have every week on the show. But then there's, luckily, organizers doing really important work thinking about particular pieces of this puzzle, because if we're going to break it apart, we have to break it apart both simultaneously and piece by piece. So, Jackie, are you with us yet?
Yes.
Great, Jack. So, everybody, welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines. This is, again, your host, Eric Mann, with both Manuel Criollo, the Director of Organizing of the Labor Community Strategy Center, and Jackie Byers, the head of the Black Organizing Project, who also was a leader in the Center for Third World Organizing. Jackie, how you doing?
Great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, sure. This is exciting. So, Manuel, here's the program, since you and I haven't rehearsed appropriately. What I'd like you to do is read the first page, which is goes through the whole, you know, up until national movement, and then go to the last page, which is the punchline of all the things that you're asking for, and then we'll start the conversation. Is that okay?
Yeah, of course. So on February 27, 2014, President Barack Hussein Obama launched a new national public-private initiative called My Brother's Keeper. My Brother's Keepers calls for a national task force to explore causes and propose solutions to the dire quality of life indicators for young men and boys of color across the country. High rates of illiteracy, dropping out and being pushed out of school, astronomical unemployment and incarceration rates, and poor health and life expectancy outcomes from the cradle to the grave. The initiative has generated $200 million in new foundation funding for organizing and policy on behalf of young men of color. He raised the moral challenge to the entire society, and for those of us who believe our work was critical in his political decision-making, this opportunity puts even more responsibility on us to push for the most radical structural reforms to end mass poverty, racism, and the mass incarceration of Black and Latino communities, a revolution based on the concepts of the social justice and environmental justice states, not the police and warfare state. The president's bold breakthrough is not an isolated event from a response, but it's a response to decades of intrepid, audacious, and relentless and vibrant organizing carried out by hundreds of groups, Citizens for a Better Greenville, Friends and Families of Louisiana Incarcerated Children, Advancement Project, Southern Echo, Power U, Youth Justice Coalition, CADRE, Padres y Jóvenes Unidos, DRUM, Make the Road New York, Sisters and Brothers United, Critical Resistance, All of Us or None, Philadelphia Student Union, Youth United for Change, the Dream Defenders, the Black Organizing Project, Ella Baker Center, Voices for Youth for Chicago Education, Kenwood Oakland Community Organization, Blocks Together Chicago, Dignity in Schools Campaign, Gay Straight Alliance Network, Alliance for Educational Justice, ACLU, Southern Law and Poverty, Drug Policy Alliance, The Gathering of Justice, Barrios Unidos, Homies Unidos, Becoming a Man, Brothers Sons Cells Coalitions, Boy and Men of Color Alliance, and the Labor Community Strategy Center. This power movement was worked to frontally challenge the complex ideology of racial subjugation, including but not limited to the film Fruitvale Station, Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow. On our recent report, Black, Brown, and Over Police in Los Angeles Schools, Structural Proposals to End the School-to-Prison Pipeline in Los Angeles and the Unified School District, and to Build a National Movement to Stop Mass Incarceration of Black and Latino Communities. And what it ended with was sort of a punchline to say that we need to push demands for our movements that have carried over the last generations. Things like books, not bars, counselors, not cops, build an environmental social justice state, not a prison police warfare state. We need to put state violence, police brutality, police misconduct on the agenda. Likewise, move to the abolishment of the laws that legalize the murder of Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis. Understand Stand Your Grounds law. We must address the racist nature of the criminal justice systems through cutting its budget by 90%, dismantle the so-called wars on drugs, gangs, and crimes that are in reality a war on our communities, expand deferred actions for all immigrants, end all deportations, as 30 members of Congress have urged the president to do so, and demand amnesty and open borders for all immigrants to reverse the 410,000 deportations in just 2012 alone, disrupt the school-to-prison pipeline, expand the social outcomes and indicators to embrace young women, LGBTQ youth, parents, and entire communities, put our educational policies and school discipline policies back in the hands of educators, students, and parents, move toward freeing the U.S. 2.4 million prisoners, and begin to shrink our federal and state prisons and local jails and end the criminalization of our communities. Move all those funds, maintaining those violent apparatuses, toward preschool, K-12 schools, higher education, mental health, substance abuse, and more unemployment opportunities. We can't escape the reality that this initiative has our imprint, and as movement builders, we cannot just stay as social critics or background cheerleaders. It is our duty to put forward bold demands, build more leaders, win real changes in our communities, build movements on a state and national level, and yes, I would say attempt to influence the direction of my brother's keeper. Our role is not just to criticize or to be dire skeptics, but to build critical consciousness, take every opportunity that the system is forced to make as an outcome of our work, and be prepared to struggle, dare to win, and understand that the power lays in the power of the people, not just in the limits of public-private partnerships and the limitations of the presidency.
Well, I think that was pretty terrific, having read it 20 or 30 times. And one thing I wanted to start talking to you about, Manuel, and Jackie, we're going to have you on. You know, this is a conversation, so just sort of picture the three of us hanging around, and we're talking to each other, really, and our listeners are just lucky enough to be, as I say, at the bar with us, if that's okay. So, Manuel, let me start with this, that in reading this, the things I'm really struck by, among a million things, is the first thing is what I'm really glad we read the first page, because look at all the groups, and that's not in any way comprehensive. That was just an effort to try to give credit to as many groups as possible, and certainly we could have put another 50 down there. So that's the first thing, is there's a lot of work being done, right? I mean, that's pretty exciting. Then you go to the last page, and there is the beginnings of a sort of a comprehensive set of demands that would break down mass incarceration, but there's still not, in my opinion, a coherent movement that the average person could say, yeah, I get all these groups are really fighting for the same thing. And I know that we're trying to use as one the U.S. 2.4 million prisoners, free the U.S. 2.4 million as maybe an overview. But before we get to that, my question is, what's the state of the movement? What's the state of these groups moving past all the terrific work they're doing? How much do they see themselves as a movement?
Well, I think, one, there is a real movement. I guess I could say I wasn't here to see any prior. I've lived only in the counter-revolution. I was born in the 70s. I'm not going to say when in the 70s, but I was born in the 70s. And I've only seen, you know, sort of the white backlash of what we perceive as the great backlash against the real civil rights revolution. But I would say this, is that the movement to end the school-to-prison pipeline has basically, probably, I don't know, thousands of people active in every, almost virtually everything from big urban schools to small rural schools to even suburban schools that have been building a movement to try to end school harsh discipline practices, zero tolerance, and taking on the gamut of a lot of issues of how the criminal justice system has creeped up into our schools. Let me say some of the things that I think are really positive about it. It's very black-led, right, which is very important.
That's right.
Two, that in contrast to a lot of work I've done before in other sort of arenas like environmental justice or social justice stuff, because the nexus of education and incarceration, the conversation about policing and the criminalization of life and the specific ways that black and brown people are being criminalized is addressed in sort of a totality. It's not viewed like, oh yeah, you know, I really want to take on discipline but not talk about race. It often has to, because the main people who are one of the primary victims or one of the primary groupings of people that are particularly hard hit is the black community and Latino immigrants, right? And the federal government even had to recognize just a week ago that the punishment of black children starts in preschool. So it's 4-year-olds that are getting suspended or expelled from preschool. And the third is that it's building the momentum of really forcing a lot of different institutions to take it very seriously. One is sort of liberal foundations, right? Again, I would say 10 years ago, the issue was a lot about equity and educational equity and sort of college prep sort of forms, right. Important work that needs to be done. But that the centrality of taking on punishment and discipline as an important sort of arena of struggle has been picked up by both very liberal sort of foundations to obviously a lot of local communities that have now, you know, have been transforming their schools. And even just 3 months ago, President Obama and through the Department of Justice and Department of Education had to basically say, there is a problem here, folks, and we need to begin to change the zero tolerance in our schools, need to really curb back the role of police in school discipline. So in that sense, it's getting to a place where it's getting both making real changes on the ground. It's engaging with a lot of different forces. But yeah, I would say the real challenge is going to be, will we be able to move beyond just discipline, suspensions, and tickets to broadly more addressing the mass incarceration that black and brown people are doing? I think on the positive, we can have that conversation. The question is, are we going to make that leap or not?
Well, one thing, Mambo, is that there's been a lot of criticism of My Brother's Keeper, more than I thought. Like, for instance, Melissa Harris Perry did a really interesting article saying President Obama has contributed to this culture of dependency. This, the family's responsibility has not broken with a challenge to racist society, which I was surprised in a good sense. I mean, for her to say that don't blame the Republicans for the discourse about blaming our people. I think those of us, you know, both Jackie, you and me, could make 100 criticisms. Ironically, what's positive about this? You know, I mean, because we'll get to the lack of real funding, the still putting the burden back on communities, which is in your articles. But you're arguing, let's not also basically make left errors, or let's not be dour critics. What would you say to the critics who say, well, what's good about this thing?
Well, I think one is that it's put in a national conversation, that President Obama has to speak about the incarceration of black men, the criminalization at a young age, that our educational institutions are failing young people, that there is both structural neglect and sort of societal neglect. Given the discourse of the last 30 years of blaming the victim, of blaming almost virtually all sort of social ills on the individual or on a set of communities, I think it gives us the opportunity to, one, raise that there is a public discourse of challenging this discourse that's out there. The second is that, again, it really helps begin to move a lot of momentum that's already happening on the ground. Again, that Los Angeles has been able to eliminate willful defiance as a suspendable offense, that 90% of all the truancy tickets have gone down at LUSD, that LAPD tickets have gone down 60%. That was not based on a basis of only sort of a social critique, but in fact, it's troops on the ground that are shifting and moving these sort of changes on the ground. I think that what it does, it opens up a set of conversation, and it's our job to basically ramp through it, to put real radical demands on it. Because if we just sort of say we're not going to engage it, when in fact they're making an engagement with us, right? The Department of Justice is putting out consent decrees. It is suing local districts. It is supporting some of the on the ground. And I think that sort of balance of work that's happening, I think, is a critical arena of struggle.
And I would agree, because under the very difficult circumstances, even when our Mayor Garcetti says, I'm not sure I'm going to agree with you to stop the fare increase, but I think it's an economic justice issue. We haven't gotten anybody to say it's an economic justice issue. If he says, I'm for free public transportation, but I'm not sure we can afford it, at least he opened up the door to say he believes in free public transportation. So I do think that some of the kind of ideological openings from the Obama administration have been very important. Moving to Jackie, really nice to have you on Voices from the Front Lines. I guess my first question is that in this period of anti-black ideology, including, unfortunately, during the whole Obama administration, it's pretty bold to start something called the Black Organizing Project. Why did you choose that as a name and as a strategy?
Yes, thank you again, Eric, and thank you, Manuel. I think that there's always sort of an anti-black sentiment. And so for us, there's been a lot of work to talk about multiracial organizing and the importance, you know, having a united front, especially as people of color. But one of the things that we continue to see is that there is sort of a black invisibility even within our movements, even among our allies, where it gets to the point where you can't just say black. And yet we see that there continues to be the disproportionate arrest of black people, black students, all the way to black children. And that we felt that it's important for us to recognize the very specific issues that are impacting the black community. But even more, in this country, if we're going to talk about building a real movement, we can't do it without black people. And as long as there continues to be sort of this ignoring or just kind of even explicitly not dealing with the issues that are happening with black people or thinking about how we organize black people, we're not going to win anything. And so for us, it was important and critical for us to say that as we all are fighting together for these changes for a better world, a better condition for all people, we have to be real direct and clear that we have to organize black people. And so for us being in Oakland, it also seemed significant, given the history here in Oakland, that we began looking at, well, how do we even, you know, let's start organizing right here. And because even though this is such a progressive city with all of this history, you still see the same issues, still the criminalization, still the murder of black men and boys, still the black children being pushed out of school, and still not enough leadership and voice coming from low-income or working-class black people. And so we felt like it was critical. And during the time that we decided to make the decision, you know, post-Hurricane Katrina, you saw all of these black faces all over the news and sort of the blatant kind of inhumanity of the United States to even move and the structures that were created, the conditions that were created. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. And then even to some degree, it just called us to question what is our ability to move even as a movement. And then, of course, with the murder of Oscar Grant happening right here in Oakland, there was a lot of sort of conversation and profile around the life of a young black man, and right after he was murdered, there were several other murders by the hands of various police departments right here in Oakland. And at the same time, there was all of this sort of euphoria around President Obama being the first black president. But there was, even within the black community, there was sort of this level of energy, but nowhere to really put it or place it.
Well, Jackie, let me move on that. That was great. I mean, one thing I wanted to say is that the Strategy Center, we see ourselves as a black liberation organization and a Latino liberation organization, but not simply as a people of color organization, as you were saying, because we had a discussion, and this is going to be kicked back to you again, with Mumia Abu-Jamal on this radio show, where we actually stumbled on, or I stumbled on, the conversation about black revolutionary thought and the particular role that the black movement has played in leading all oppressed nationality and white people in this country. Mm-hmm. So one of the differences when Manuel says, we keep saying that I was lucky enough to see the revolution with my own eyes, mm-hmm. and that revolution was a black-led revolution. And back then, Latinos, Asian Pacific Islanders, whites, indigenous people gave a particular shout-out to the black movement and said that, you know, whether it was AIM or any Latino group, they say, we look to the Black Panthers, we look to Malcolm, we look, you know, I don't think a lot of that is happening right now. So I think that the concept of a black organizing project is particularly bold because it does call the black question.
Yeah, absolutely. And we definitely have been called to question when we decided to do it. And that's also interesting, too, is sort of people's uncomfortability with the concept. And kind of questions around, so, you know, is it, how can it just be black? And is it what does that mean, sort of, you're anti-other people, and all of those kinds of questions. And what was also interesting is, as you said, and I'm also a 70s born baby, so I just kind of have sort of the, you know, residual memories of a lot of these critical moments. But as we began to organize here, you would have some elders who remembered those moments, or remembered those times, or were part of the times of the Black Panther Party here in Oakland. But you also had a lot of young people who have never seen or experienced or been part of something that was a Black space really addressing Black specific issues. And so for us, it was also powerful to think about how can people actually have that experience and know that that is real and that it's possible for us to organize together. And as we organize in unity with other groups, there's also something powerful about us being able to learn how to organize together, given so many things that have been set into place to sort of destroy our ability to even organize over a long period of time, and the destruction of those institutions and communities that existed, where people could then come together politically. And there's been so much destruction of that over the years that part of our organizing work is, in fact, recreating some of that foundation.
That was the voice of Jackie Byers, who was with the Center for Third World Organizing. I don't know your whole history, Jackie. Is now a director of the Black Organizing Project in Oakland, and you've also heard from Manuel Criollo. Here's a question I want to ask both of you. I think that one of the things that's been lost, and again, this conversation, I urge our listeners to go on our site, www.voicesfromfrontlines.com, and go back and listen to the conversation. There's two between Mamia Abdul-Jamal and myself, not just about Black revolutionary history, but also about the culture of reading, because I think it's really important for oppressed nationality people to be writing more theory and strategy. So here we have Black, Brown, and Over-Policed. We have My Brother's Keeper, which was published in the Black Commentator. And we really want to thank Peter Gamble, the publisher of the Black Commentator, for his tremendous openness to just about anything we've written and reaching out to Manuel. Now you have The New Separate and Equal. So one question is for both of you to think about is, how do we get our own people to read? In other words, we publish all these things and we ask the world to read, but how do we reconstruct the ability to read word by word, sentence by sentence, concept by concept, so that at the end of the day, all the things that we fought over, all these little words that we think are so important, can actually reside in the brains of a new generation of organizers. So giving you a second to think about that. So hey, everybody, welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines. This is a movement show every Tuesday from 4 to 5. It's a particular show. It's on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web. So, Jackie, you can listen every Tuesday at 4 on kpfk.org. And you can also, more realistically, download the shows from www.voicesfromfrontlines.com, which you should spend an hour every week downloading the show. It's always a great show. And next week, I almost know how to say it, we're going to start having tweets during the show at Eric Mann Speaks on Twitter. So, and we're going to have somebody in studio listening to your profound tweets. So we're going to read them on the air. And so start going to www.voicesfromfrontlines. If you haven't registered, please register on the site, because that means you're going to get the weekly newsletter that usually goes out Tuesday morning that explains who's going to be on the show Tuesday and lets you know what's up. And we want to be able to reach out to people about taking action. That is to say, we don't really want listeners, we want organizers. So we're back with Manuel Criollo and Jackie Byers, and I want to discuss the role of publications for a minute. When the Strategy Center began, we initiated the role of having a lead document for every campaign, a sort of an intellectual, moral, strategic, make the case. We worked on LA's Lethal Air, and I remember it took almost a year to write, and there were sort of elected officials that were sort of starting to talk about air pollution, and I got sort of nervous. I said to Chris Matheson, "Darn, it's taken so long to write this." He said, "Don't worry, Eric. These elected officials are interested for 30 seconds. When our paper comes out, it's going to get attention." So we wrote LA's Lethal Air, New Strategies for Policy Organizing and Action. Then, when the Urban Rebellion happened, we wrote a call to reject the federal weed and seed program, which was influential, by the way, in defeating the federal weed and seed program, which we defeated in L.A. Mm-hmm. L.A.'s Lethal Air contributed to a lot of victories at the Alcoholic Management District and against Texaco. Then we published Reconstructing L.A. and U.S. Cities from the Bottom Up, which started our articulation of the social welfare state, not the police state, in 1993. So now we have at least three really excellent ones, and Jackie, because you guys work on this together, I want to segue a little bit to the new separate and equal, using California's local control funding formula to dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline by the Community Rights Campaign of the Labor Community Strategy Center and the Black Organizing Project. But before I get to the content, I want to still go to the issue of reading, because as we turn out, I think, really excellent, beautifully presented, well-written, great graphics, how do we get a new generation to understand the value of reading? I'll start with you, Manuel, and then Jackie, perhaps you've done some thinking about this.
Well, you know, Eric, from my point of view, I guess, I think a lot about my own life. I grew up here in Los Angeles in the barrios of Pico Union and in South L.A., and I was a nerdy but depressed and angry brown boy, and I was bussed out to the valley. I had pretty much a failing, my point GPA, I know a lot of the nerds say my GPA was 4.0, 3.8. Mine was probably like a 1.2 GPA.
Wow.
And, I went to a school that was pretty significantly white. I was with one of the desegregators. And one of the most momentous things in my life was a Latino teacher who I thought was totally like your classic Hispanic kind of like sort of tidy with always a little tie and everything, and I couldn't stand him either. And we were reading Huckleberry Finn. I could not read Huckleberry Finn for the life of me. It didn't speak to me in any way. And he gave me a book. He gave me Bless Me Ultima, which obviously now it's a movie, and it's a beautiful film about a boy and his grandmother. And really, it was the first book I had ever read in my life, and I was now 15. And it made me basically grab every book I could see. And what were the first books I grabbed was Malcolm X autobiography, Malcolm Speaks. I really love this book called La Raza by Stan Steiner. It's like a 5-year sort of snapshot of the Chicano power movement. And it really transformed my life. So for me, at least when we're organizing young people and we're organizing adults, to me, the written language is very powerful. One of the main things that attracted me to the Strategy Center was reconstructing L.A. from the bottom up. It was immigrant rights and wrongs, because it not only had sort of an analysis, but it had a strategy and it had a tactical game plan. So it really spoke to me. And so I think we are continuing to try to continue that pattern in our taking actions in community rights campaign. There's a lot of attention to the written language. Almost virtually every exercise has some written spectrum. When we got together, we've been doing these exchanges with the Black Organizing Project, and we did this sort of like the systems of oppression, and we went from everything from slavery to lease convict leasing to mass incarceration. And again, it was this concept of really breaking down each system, and you can't do that in a sort of picture. You can't just do that by giving a rap. You have to give some written sort of language to it. And I think of some of the greatest heroes that saved my life. And at least for a tradition that I'm very thankful, I still think is very critical, especially when you think about the whole history that people were even denied even the right to either learn the written language or even speak their own language.
Jackie, I'll get to you in a second. I just want to respond to Manuel on something, to respond to both of you, which is, at the BRU Planning Committee, we've been having a really good experience, which is, I am a primary writer, but now we're really happy we have Ron Collins, who really likes to write, and we're trying to encourage people to write as well as to read. So I did an art, you know, we did two articles. One was The Limits of the Law that was published in OR Now, which my wife Leanne Hurstman is the editor of, and we went back and read it, and what we read it out loud. And one of the things I was struck by is that what I've learned from this is we have to slow it down, because a lot of times what happens is reading or any idea is based on you have to understand concept A if you want to move to concept B. If you move fast and assume that everybody understands concept B, A, the person who didn't is already lost, feels bad. By the time you get to concept B, she's still trying to figure out concept A. By the time you get to C, and that happened to me in geometry, seriously, I phased out within 3 days. I decided I couldn't learn geometry because it moved too fast, and everything was building on the other point, and I just remember sitting in class saying, I'm going to flunk it. I had no interest in it because, and I had to go get a tutor who went back to basics, and I was shocked that I could understand it. So we've been doing this thing about let's not move on until does everybody really like this concept. We discuss that concept, and then we move, and it's been fun. It's been fun to have the planning committee partly as a reader group. So that's been interesting for me. And Jackie, how is the role of the written word integrating into your organizing? What are you thinking about the role of writing and organizing?
Yeah, it's a really great question, because I also have a somewhat similar background to Manuel, and I also think that that sort of the current education or miseducation system that people have gone through in a lot of ways has sort of, you know, has created this sense that, you know, we don't know, we can't learn, we're not as smart. There's all these sort of things that have happened by being sort of thrown into a system that is really not designed to really educate anyone well. And so a lot of times, you know, folks bring that in because what we found, even when we've done, we do a class at a continuation school, and, you know, these are the kids that have been pushed out of all the, you know, mainstream schools, but they, when the bell rings, they don't leave. And a lot of it is because we actually create a space with relevant information that is real, and there's place for them to dialogue and to critique and to understand and to apply the concepts or the information or the topics we're going over. And so I think that in part, as we're organizing, and we're dealing with ourselves as well as the communities we're organizing in, it's true that there's been this system or structure that has sort of made people feel less confident in terms of reading and writing what they can contribute and what they know. So one of the things we've done as a practice is we have book clubs, and so we take our time and we do it collectively. And so we read Detroit, I Do Mind Dying. We read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. You know, we've read a couple other books along the way, more specific around education and articles collectively together. And as we've done it, we've also thought about how does this apply? How do we use this in our organizing? How does this apply to our organizing? And more often than not, we've also found that people, as we read, people can, they can relate to and connect, and therefore the art of reading, it's exciting. It's people, you know, get into it, people are passionate about it, and so a lot of it is creating the space and the practice. And then the other kind of two things that we try to do is we have this Our Story series or space that we've created, which is really about not telling his story, but telling our story. And so it's a space where we'll take a concept like, you know, it could be mass incarceration and or jobs and economics, and we create both panels of folks who might give information, but we also create a lot of space for dialogue and conversation on a topic so that we're also teaching each other. And we also have connected to that newsletters that we try to get guest writers from the community or the membership so that people can get used to sort of putting their own story and their own point of view. And so it's something that we're trying to practice as an organization and trying to create space where people just have an opportunity to see what they already know and to change the way that oftentimes, unfortunately, education has been done in such a punitive way
right.
that people who would love to learn. I mean, for me, I was one of those at-risk, almost dropped out of high school kids, and it really wasn't until I had the opportunity to go to college that I was like, actually, I love to learn. But I wouldn't have known it because of I didn't fit in the system that was set up for me.
Well, I think this is very exciting, and it just shows that, of course, I dream up. Everything I hear leads me to want to do something, you know. So my next thing is, God, we should do a formulation of all the different work that is being done about literacy, reading, thinking, you know, which a lot of us don't necessarily talk to each other about. Just really quickly, I was in Newark in the black community in 1967, 8, 9, and I worked with the Newark Community Union Project, and then we went back last year for the 90th birthday party of Terry Jefferson, who was one of the leaders in the movement and who died a week later after her 90th birthday. And a man who, if you can imagine, this is almost, I think, 50 years or 48 years. So the man, maybe 12 years younger than me or something, came up and said, do you remember when you took me to Columbia University to a writing workshop where we did experimental writing? And I want you to know it's the first time I ever did writing, and it's changed my whole life. And I didn't remember. But I thought, oh, my God, I did something good, you know. And I had to remember that there was so much excitement about teaching young black kids to write, you know, that was a real exciting project. So there's a long tradition of this, you know, there's Septima Clark, there's, you know, all this good stuff that we got to get into. But this is very, very cool. So now let's segue, and we got about 12 minutes. I said we were going to go to the phones, but I want to, 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, if you want to talk to Jackie Byers and to Marwal Kiyoyo about literacy, about the president's, my brother's keeper, about the specificity of black oppression. There's only two rules on this show. One, you actually have to relate to the conversation, folks. So if you have some theory you want to discuss that has nothing to do with this, you will be ruled out of order. And two, try to do it in 2 minutes. But we have terrific listeners, and with those 818-985-5735, it's generated some really terrific callers. So if you'd like to call in, we're going to keep talking, but I'm going to be looking at the phones. And as soon as you get on the line, we will slow down this conversation and put you on. I should have done it sooner. But I want to move to the new separate and equal about, briefly, Manuel, explain this idea that first they tried to make funding for the schools more equal, which is a good thing, mm-hmm. but that they haven't yet dealt with the issue of police funding.
Right.
And then maybe you and Jackie could talk about that being the premise. 818-985-5735, that's KPFK.
Well, again, Eric, you know, Black Organizing Project and the Strategy Center have been talking for almost 2 years, right? And, you know, it's funny enough, we got together last summer, and while we do a lot of work around school-to-prison pipeline, we didn't really talk a lot about the school-to-prison pipeline. We talked broader questions about black oppression, about black and brown unity, about, you know, miseducation and right. sort of mass incarceration, just to get a grasp of what we're all trying to do and what we're looking at sort of in a broader question. On the very specific, though, we have been trying to play a lot of leadership, because even within the school-to-prison pipeline work, even though it says school to prison, a lot of the work is actually only about exclusionary sort of suspensions and expulsions in school. And the touching of the police is a whole other, like,
that's
gamut
right.
of group. Like, a lot of policy groups wouldn't want to touch the police, right? It's sort of like, don't do anything but not touch the police. And one of the things that we've been doing is really trying to uplift this conversation about school policing. And so this new brief that we wrote, called The New Separate and Unequal, is trying to do three things. One is talking about the new separate and unequal, meaning that public urban schools or schools with majority-minority populations
right.
have increased police presence in their schools. And so one of the things that this report shows is that in 2010, 2011, that there was over 20,000 arrests in California schools, over 30,000 school police referrals across the state,
wow.
And second, that the money that, you know, you would assume schools should be spending on counselors, psychologists, social workers, you know, sort of alternatives to a lot of these punishment cultures in our schools. In fact, we see a huge increase of actual money that's being spent on policing.
Right.
And Los Angeles is one of the capitals of the world because we have the largest school police department. We have one of the largest security budgets in the system. So what we try to do at least is expose how different schools are making decisions around policing and real critical sort of social service staffs. And lastly, as you're saying, is there is an opportunity now where, you know, through Prop 30 and the local control funding formula, which is basically a formula that is supposed to give a hand up to schools that have student low-income students, English learners, and children who are in the foster care system inside school districts to be able to at least get additional resources to support that population and support sort of the conversation about equity, but the whole conversation about race, about educational equality that's been denied because of Prop 13 and sort of the denial of sort of underfunding our public schools. The problem is that how is that money going to be spent now? Now that we have additional money, is that money going to be now just adding to what we've already seen, which is the increased sort of role of policing in our schools?
Manuel, and then Jackie, what do you want from the LAUSD? And Jackie, what do you want from the Oakland school systems? 818, oh, hold on. We got some callers. We'll get Alec on the phone, and then we got Al. And then please direct your questions to the speakers, to the guests. Al, you on your phone?
Yeah, I'm on my phone. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Well, thank you for having me on the air. Really interesting show. My question is regarding Marxism and socialism. So you guys are talking about sort of the history of black liberation and also about how ideas and thoughts play into the struggle. And I'm wondering sort of what you all think with the defeat of socialism in the Soviet Union and China, sort of the ebb of socialist thought in the world, sort of the absence of those kinds of big ideas and how that plays into the struggle for a better world.
That's great. We'll give both Manuel and then Jackie. And thanks for getting right to the point. That was a great question.
May I have to ask one more thing?
Nope. You made your point, and now listen to the answer.
Well, thanks for that. You know, obviously, I think, at least for me personally, and our tradition is sort of a black left, you know, black Marxism, black working class rooted, you know, oppressed nationality rooted sort of perspective in history and society. And so clearly there is a important Marxist thinkers that inside the black community and Latino communities that at least I myself look at toward, you know, people like Harry Haywood, people like, Sarah James, and a whole gamut of important sort of both thinkers and actors in society. But, you know, so I think obviously it's been something that we engage in. One of the things that we talk about when we talk about the parallels of the convict leasing movement and sort of, you know, broad lynchings that happened in the United States, that one of the most important movements was the movement of We Cry Genocide, which was led by both Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois. And so talk about that whole movement of going to the United Nations. That was not just a sort of a movement from nowhere. It was an actual important sort of place where both, you know, the black community, but also obviously a lot of movements within socialism and inside the Communist Party who were playing that kind of role to bring up those kind of demands.
Jackie, what role do you think the concept of socialism plays in your own ideology and your own work, like the listener said?
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, well, one of the things that, you know, is true, and Emmanuel kind of talked about it, I mean, we're working on this specific issue, but it's so much, this issue of school discipline, of police in schools cannot be disconnected from all the other larger issues that come from capitalism and come from all of the the history of how these things are intertwined. Why are black and brown people being murdered? What's happening to our land and how we're being pushed out of our communities and all of that. So for us, these are conversations that we have within our membership and our community, and talking about, for us, a lot of it is, what are we trying to fight for? And that's a really critical question for us, because as we're sort of winning these reforms that are important, we're always having to revisit, but what are we really fighting for? And therefore, who do we need to be fighting with? and what is it that we're fighting against? And those are conversations that are happening with. And for us also, people are at varying levels of sort of political activism and connection. And so for us, it's also about creating space to have that real deep dialogue and even dig deeper into what we're actually talking about. And sometimes it's not necessarily, you know, people don't sort of know Marxist ideology, but it's having the conversation about what does all of this mean and unraveling it, unpacking it, and creating space like we talked about earlier for us to actually have some study, some reading together and some sort of diving in and in some cases critiquing, because for us there's also been some problems with where Black people have been in some of the larger movements, you know, recently, and in the left, and getting left behind. And so how do we make sure that doesn't happen as well?
I want to make sure we get Al on the phone with his question, and then if I get a last second, maybe I will, but I want to make sure Manuel and Jackie get the answer. Al, thanks for being on Voices from the Frontlines. What's your question?
Thanks for the opportunity. Just a very quick question. Can you delineate specific strategies that you're using to address the problems that you've been talking about? You know, the lady that just finished speaking, she began to talk about a key issue that I keep running into, is that not only the idea of what are you fighting for, but how are you actually in the process of fighting, if you will, the good fight. So what specifically can you say that you're doing now to address the problems that you are delineated?
Thank you so much, Manuel, Jackie, and I'm going to see if I get a sentence, but mostly you. Jackie, why don't you go first?
Okay. I mean, we do community organizing, and the issue that we're working on right now is specifically on we're trying to get rid of police in schools, but as part of our sort of methodology is that we do grassroots organizing, so, you know, it's reaching out. It's street outreach, it's door knocking, it's all that, all the things that come with sort of grassroots organizing, and it's leadership development, it's political education, and it's building relationship and creating and being connected to movement, building space. And so it's also learning how to win and change sort of the material conditions and the issues that are in front of people, while also thinking about what are we also building towards, and also testing out. And so we also like to have some room for kind of experimenting with alternative models, and in a lot of ways just learning how to practice even winning and organizing together and doing analysis together as a way to win larger issues in the future.
Thanks a lot, Manuel. And then I'm going to go in, and Nadja, how much time we got? 2 minutes. You get 1.5, I get 30 seconds.
Yeah, no, I obviously, you know, we're sister organizations, so we do very much a lot of similar aspects. I would say, you know, one of the things that drives our organizing is the concept of transformative organizing, the concept of not only transforming society and transforming policies and laws and the many obstacles that our communities are facing, you know, especially here in Los Angeles around the school to prison pipeline. But more importantly, that in that process, it's transforming people also to build, you know, a broader consciousness, the building of new leaderships, the building of new organizations in some ways. And, you know, and the last thing, you know, here is we've already seen our big victories here on the ground in our people winning real, you know, real protections and seeing, you know, young people not being ingested into the criminal justice system.
Well, I think what I'm getting out of the two terrific callers is that I think in Voices, we're going to start doing more work about the Socialist Project and more work about what does anti-imperialist Marxism look like? What does it matter, you know, in the good sense, if you were a Marxist, if you were for socialism, if you believe in anti-imperialism, how would that shape your organizing differently? And to remember that at the height of the success of the left, socialism, anti-imperialism were mass questions. And I think we have more responsibility to make those mass questions again. And I really want to thank our two listeners for getting right to the point about what's the broader ideology, what's the broader strategy, and let's give more time to that. So I want to thank Jackie Ryan. I want to thank Manuel Criollo for another really enjoyable time. We're going to hear Nina Simone taking us out. We'll be back next week on Voices from the Frontlines, and I'm going to give a lot of thinking to the two callers and to conversations we've all been having anyway. Thanks for having you both on the show. This is Voices from the Frontlines, Eric Mann. I want to thank Crystal McMillan, our producer. And I want to thank all our listeners. And next week, Twitter on, I even forget, Eric Mann Speaks. And we'll have somebody in taking your tweets. Take good care of yourselves. Bye-bye. See you next Tuesday.